Hey, in this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, we'll have the Threadripper 32 and Corex 28, Main Gear's masterful F131, Snappy Dragons at 850, a new arm with some serious legs, and Marco's going to build a monster next. Now, you see what happens when I leave the live stream running and I'm getting a delayed me in my ear. That's not cool. Marco, it's your fault.
Everything is my fault. I'm used to it.
Blame Marco for everything. Chris is innocent drinking his Voodoo Ranger.
With his nice clean little haircut going on.
With his clean cut main boy haircut. Chris. Mm-hmm. It's probably Chris, those mild-mannered guys. I left the live stream going and trying to speak, and I'm hearing myself, and like a second later, and man, you know. What's that rhyme? Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm schizophrenic, and so am I. Something like that, right? That's what I was hearing. Anyways, voices in my head. Yeah, voices in my head. Gentlemen, how are we this week? How are we doing?
Doing good. Can't complain. I think the sky's about to open up here in Connecticut. But other than that, you know, just working, chugging along, getting ready for summer, all that good stuff.
Beautiful, beautiful. Get your beach body ready, dude.
God, no. It's not even close to a beach body. My belly looks like a deflated friggin' football.
Wow. Okay. Well, chicks dig that. Chicks dig deflated footballs.
Yeah, I guess.
Tom Brady. I shouldn't even say that. He has deflated footballs.
See, now you open a can of worms.
I totally did. I walked right into it. It was too there. I couldn't not. Chris, are you gonna actually tan this summer? Do you tan, Chris?
Do I look like I've seen the sun in years?
You look like an IT guy.
So yes, trapped in the cave, never let out.
You have that swank, labor. That swank CRT tan, baby. Mm-hmm. Which isn't CRT, it's LCD now, but close enough. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, we've got lots going on in the land of tech, the headlines, the reviews. It's been a little while. I was traveling last week, so we missed it. I was out in damn hot. There's like three levels of hot in Texas. I was in Austin seeing Dell. There's like hot, damn hot, and oh my God, it's hot. Those are the three climates they have this time of year. And so I was traveling out there, and so we actually missed, it shouldn't have been an excuse, but we missed last week. And so we've got a little bit of catch up to do. Lots of stuff going on. Lots of amazing stuff going on at Computex actually this week. We are not there. We're here stateside. So we get to talk to you, and that's cool. But yeah, let's dive right in, because the good stuff is flowing from the Far East, from lots of different brands all over the world. And Marco, the folks at AMD surprised us last night with something rather special in many cord, a new version of Threadripper. And even Intel stepped out with a high core count CPU as well to try and catch their thunder. But what do you know? And let's talk about these beasts, because they're looking pretty fabulous.
Yeah, so I'm super excited. We know a lot, but we don't know everything. We know enough to talk about it. And it's really interesting stuff. So let's start with AMD. They showed some really awesome stuff at Computex. In addition to showing off, you know, a whole bunch of partner machines and notebooks with Ryzen, they unveiled some new and upcoming products. Now, let me quickly talk about the GPU first, even though you mentioned Threadripper, because we'll focus on CPUs after. So AMD showed working GPU 7-nanometer Radeon with 32 gigabytes of HBM2. They showed a Radeon Instinct doing a ray tracing workload live on stage. It all seemed to work great. They did not reveal sort of speeds and feeds. They did say that moving to 7-nanometer doubles the density, so potentially double the number of compute units on these GPUs. We're not certain yet. Obviously, 32 gigs, a massive amount of HBM2. And, you know, live on stage, they showed this big ray tracing workload, you know, not real time. You can see the pixels kind of, you know, resolving in the demo, but completely usable. And I'm sure that would be great for content creators. Now that there were some changes made to the GPU. It's not simply Vega shrunk down. This is not Navi. This is still a Vega based GPU, but there were some tweaks made for it to enhance deep learning performance and to enhance some blockchain functions as well. Specifically, those details weren't disclosed, but there is new GPU stuff coming from AMD, and if I'm remembering correctly, they're committing to some sort of new GPU release every year, not necessarily a new architecture, but new GPU release every year. That could mean a rebrand. It could mean something else, but that's good news to hear that they're sort of still focused in that area. Now, as cool as that was, I'm super excited for what they showed with the new Threadrippers.
Yeah, baby.
There were two demos on stage, live working demos, and according to James Pryor of AMD, these were in, you know, it was kind of tough to see in the videos, but these were air-cooled Threadripper, second gen Threadrippers, using a new cooler that is going to be made available with a full coverage plate for these new Threadrippers. Now here's what's awesome. Current gen Threadrippers, biggest baddest bad boy, the 1950X, is a 16 core chip.
Yeah,
they showed a 24 core and a 32 core beast live working, saying that it's, you know, on track for a Q3 release. Now the 24 core second gen Threadripper running a Blender workload clearly outpaced a Intel Core i9 CPU on stage. And then they showed, now they didn't do the exact same workload, I'm sure, so that you couldn't make direct comparisons because they added some additional lighting to the render. Then they showed the 32 core chip working, and it literally just blew through this Blender workload. And on top of that, these new chips are going to work in the existing platform, flash a BIOS. So if you already have a Threadripper chip, you can flash a BIOS and upgrade to the latest ones. I think these things are going to be awesome. So knowing what we know about the Zen Plus cores, going to have higher clocks, lower latencies, in addition to support for faster memory and a better boost algorithm. So all of that put together spells one kick-ass processor, in my opinion. I really am looking forward to checking these things out.
Yeah, man, that is an impressive chip for sure. And you know what's interesting about it is, you know, we were surprised by it, and you learn in this business not to be surprised by much, but we were surprised by it. If we really thought it through back when the first iteration of Threadripper came out with the max 16 core count in the package, and we know that underneath the lid of that processor, two of the die locations, because they're in a little quad of placements underneath the heat spreader, two of the dies are actually dummy. They're not active silicon, and they're just there to balance the heat spreader and the design in terms of, you know, literally, you know, in terms of mechanicals. And so if we thought about that, the substrate's there, you know, you've got two locations for two more die. Yeah, we should have sort of projected at some point this would have happened. But, sure. You know, at the time, AMD didn't need it. It was, you know, that 16 core chip was all they needed to compete with Intel at the high end. Now they're up in their game. One thing that came to mind to me with Threadripper in terms of second generation architecture, you mentioned latency improvements and some of the enhancements, the tweaks that AMD did in Zen Plus. How do we think that will translate as core counts scale? It theoretically should improve even more so, right? Because as you have more hops through the CCXs and some of the fine tuning and the enhancements, the more cores, the better scaling improvement you get across the architecture, right? Is that a fair deduction?
Yes and no. So if you're talking about the current mainstream Ryzens, the latency reduction is still staying all on one die. We don't know exactly how it's going to affect latency from one die to another die until we test it. Now, I'm going to assume that there were tweaks made to Infinity Fabric. And because of improved memory support, the Infinity Fabric runs at the memory speed. At least it did in current gen. Maybe that's going to change. I'm not certain. But with tweaks to the memory compatibility, tweaks to the memory timings, tweaks to, you know, tweaks to the Infinity Fabric itself, I have to assume that AMD is going to 32 cores now because it's all going to look nice. Now, when the first ones came out, 16 cores was super exciting. It kind of changed the game. It spurred Intel to release many core chips as well. And almost everybody was sort of super excited for Threadripper and loved it when they tested it out. I think the timing is right now to up the core counts again, which is why they did it. I think if they came right out with a 32 core desktop chip, everyone would have said, oh, they're nuts. Nobody needs that. Who needs 32 cores? That's a waste. Who needs that?
Right. But
they did the 16 core, everybody upped their game. And now it's like, let's do it again. Yay. So
yeah.
And now, and it also accomplishes something else that's really cool. If you think about AMD's desktop product stack, you can now go from, and this is just talking about, I'm not talking about Raven Ridge, just the mainstream, the performance Ryzen lineup. You can go from a 6-core all the way up to a 32-core. And yes, there's more than one die, but the same die across that whole stack. I mean, that really took some planning. Just some excellent execution. AMD is just rocking it right now.
Yeah, the architecture is extremely scalable, and that is it's one of its key advantages. Probably, I would say maybe its most key advantage versus Intel. And surprisingly, Intel tried to head them off at the pass. They demoed a 28-core, 56-thread, 5 gigahertz. We assume that's not all cores. Core X CPU, so this must be X299 platform compatible, a 28-core Core i9. Oh, I think they'll call it Core i9. We don't know what they'll call it, but a 28-core processor, Marco, right? They stepped out a couple days before.
Yeah, now this one, the Intel announcement's a little trickier, in my opinion.
Yeah.
They didn't say whether or not it was a new core that would be released at the end of the year, right? But what they showed was a Skylake X. So a 28-core Skylake X is essentially the same 28-core that's used in the Xeon Platinum lineup, like the 8176 and I think the 8180 are the model numbers that are 28-core Xeon. So they are, for that demo, the Xeon die was basically repurposed. Now, that Xeon die does not run at 5 gigahertz without exotic cooling. So to do that demo, either it was a new stepping and Intel's just being coy, or they had to, you know, resort to some extreme cooling measures to show that. Now, all 28 cores running at 5 gigahertz is going to consume an insane amount of power. So without an awesome power supply and an awesome motherboard and awesome cooling, existing stuff's not going to do that reliably, especially, you know, especially on air. It's just not going to happen with what's out right now. Now, Intel is not a company that can just say, we're releasing a 28-core chip that can run at 5 gigahertz and then not do it, right? They have to answer to shareholders, they have to answer to all of us, they have to answer to all of their fans, you know, everybody in tech. So the exciting thing is, desktops, Intel will have a highly clocked 28-core chip for enthusiasts, which is awesome. I'm psyched that these many core chips are coming. We just don't really have any details other than Intel said they're going to do it. So what they showed may not necessarily be what's released.
Yeah.
But they've committed to a super high-performance chip. Now, how that compares to a 32-core Threadripper, the clocks are key. Because we know 32 Threadripper cores are going to beat 28 Skylake X cores if the clocks are similar. But if Intel can get clocks higher, and we know Intel CPUs will clock higher than AMD, could have a fight on our hands.
Right.
It'd be awesome.
Right. Yeah. No, it's interesting stuff, and it really sort of underscores the differences in the architectures. I mean, clearly Intel doesn't seem to have, well, certainly they would have, you know, scaled higher if they could have, doesn't have the scalability that AMD has in their architecture. However, Intel does have, as you noted, the clock speed and then the single threaded IPC advantage as well. So, you know, there's some differences there, but AMD's extremely scalable architecture really is paying dividends for them. Their stock was up sharply today, by the way. It was up like 6% last I saw. I am a shareholder, by the way, full disclosure. I do own a small position in AMD, relatively anyways. And but yeah, their stock is reflecting, and it's cheap right now. It's like $15, which, you know, when you compare to Intel, I think they're probably somewhere in the 50s, or I haven't looked lately. But anyways, impressive stuff to see the folks at AMD competing so handily with Intel in their home turf. You know, big iron, heavy duty, multi-core silicon. That's what Chipzilla does. And AMD is really giving them a run for their money. Chris, what are your thoughts on this firefight?
Yes, please. I like the competition. I want to see both of them going as many cores as they can get before Microsoft gets greedy and starts going to per core licensing on the home consumer side, like they're doing with the server side. I have a little worry about that. But then everyone can jump ship to Linux, I guess. So
you will see a freaking revolution if Microsoft does that. People will go nuts.
Yeah. Not that I want to give them the idea, because I'm not happy about their server choices there still, and it's been a couple years now. But seeing these core counts balloon for content creation and everything else is just,
yeah,
it makes me giddy to see.
I wish we could see you right now, John. Switch to Chris so we can look at him. The poor guy. It's the man behind the curtain talking. That's all right. No big deal. But yeah,
one more quick point to make based on the conversation. So you said, you know, AMD's architecture more scalable. It really depends how you look, right? So really, it's not. They have one die. They have an 8-core die. Intel's architecture is more scalable if you're talking a single piece of silicon, right? They have dual core Skylakes on up to 28 core Skylakes. But what AMD did, that the Infinity Fabric is really the magic right there. So having that fast off chip communications, it was really the key, and that's the secret sauce that, you know, years ago when we had multi-chip processors and communication was going off the chip through the front side bus back on the chip, you had more core resources, but it wasn't great. You know, now you have more of a direct interconnect on the chip, and it's a very different to have a multi-chip module now, and AMD has clearly done a good job. Even this early, I mean, Threadripper is not even a year old, you know?
Right.
So even this early, it's just good stuff.
Right. It's a different way of, you're right. It's a different way of skinning the cat, so to speak. When I say scalable, it's more physically easier to scale 8-core dies and chaining them together with a fast high-speed fabric than it is to scale a monolithic die. But certainly Intel has higher core count, you know, monolithic silicon. But what's fascinating is, AMD's always had, all the way back to HyperTransport, AMD's always had a strength in serial interconnect. You know, back in the days of early days when HyperTransport was big, and then certainly, you know, all the other serial interconnect that came with it. Now we're talking chip-to-chip communication at higher bandwidth at higher speeds. However, if we think about it, and this is sort of ironic, Intel has been developing it as well, because when you talk about Kaby Lake G, the collaboration between Intel and AMD, where Radeon Graphics, Intel, you know, core architecture, eighth gen core architecture, talking over the embedded, what they call EMIB, embedded multi-die interconnect, kind of the same thing. Different processing elements, GPU and CPU, but it's a high-speed interconnect between silicon on a single substrate in one socket. So you would think Intel, if they wanted to, has the ability to chain silicon together like that quickly with high-speed interconnect. I don't know if the architecture has the hooks in it to support it. Certainly AMD architected it from the beginning, so maybe that's part of the issue, the way they built their chip. But it's fascinating, and man, it was a big bet that AMD made back in the day for Ryzen and for Zen in general, and it's paying off in spades, right? Good stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Really good stuff. You know what? You know what's funny too is the audience reaction on both sides of the fence. So we get a lot of the the signals and the reverberations in social, right, Marco, when we put these stories out and, you know, mm-hmm. you see them go to Facebook and Twitter and Google Plus and all these social platforms. The reaction to Intel's 28 core announcement was, oh God, what's that going to cost? And really cool, but man, I don't know how I'm going to afford that. And then the reaction to 32 core Threadripper was, woohoo! Everybody was pretty much just, you know, dancing.
Well, you know, AMD is going to be more aggressive on price. I don't think a 32 core Threadripper is going to be cheap, right? Yeah. That's not going to be a cheap processor, but they're going to be aggressive.
Probably and, cheaper, yeah.
Right, and if it competes in single thread and wins in multi-thread, how does Intel price it that much more? You know, this is going to be awesome for the consumer long haul. You're going to have so much choice in terms of the spread of processors available from mainstream to high end, and you're going to have tight competition between the two leaders in this space. It's good stuff all around. I can't wait to write about all this stuff. It's going to be awesome.
What's fascinating about the differences between the two architectures are the dynamics of performance and cost. You get some efficiencies with larger monolithic dies like Intel produces, right? You get better cost efficiencies with more producible smaller dies, you know, the 8-core Ryzen dies that AMD is producing. It's you get better yields. It's smaller, you know, it's technically smaller silicon. Yes, you've got some yield optimization to do with Infinity Fabric on a multi-chip module and all that good stuff. There's certainly yield involved there and cost, but yeah, it's a trade-off. And it's kind of cool. They really took a totally different angles and to get to this many core architecture and with different results and different nuances that play favorably in the market one way or the other. It's fun to watch. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
So we have Craig in the chat saying $1,300 rumor for 32 core Threadripper. I think that's probably in line, maybe $1,300 to $1,500, depending on where performance lands after they're done tuning. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, you got any projections?
Well, I just said in the chat the Intel, because Joe Nexus said that the Xeon chip that the 28 core is based on runs $9,000. So even accounting for the Xeon tax, we're still looking at probably used car territory for that one.
Oh, damn. I only have four of those in the lab. Damn.
Well, that's funny. Used car territory. That's good stuff, man. I'm sure there's probably a few Intel execs where the hair is standing on the back of their necks right now with that one, but that's good stuff. Interesting. Well, we'll have to see how it goes. It's going to be a fascinating fight to watch, and good to have it, and we're looking forward to getting it in the lab and testing it. And yeah, we're fortunate enough not to have to fork out, you know, this kind of money to actually test this processor. We don't get to enjoy them in our workstation rigs all day, every day, but at least they're on the test bench. And then maybe someday down the line, they get to a personal rig, but we get to test and play with it. And this is the kind of stuff that makes our job so fun, right?
I'm just excited. I love that there's heat and competition in this space because it's cool.
Yeah, if you're a geek, you're excited these days, that's for sure. Well, you know, let's move on, but we're going to go to something that I covered, and I'd like you guys to chime in and let me know your thoughts as well, because I don't want to do all the talking here. But I actually put up my full review of Main Gear's F131 high-performance gaming PC masterpiece, is what I called it. And I'm going to try and contain myself and remain reserved and balanced here. But there it is right there, the Main Gear F131. You can see it along with a monitor that aptly went with it, a ViewSonic, oddly enough, FreeSync monitor, but it's a 4K panel. In that machine are a pair of liquid-cooled GeForce GTX 1080 Ti graphics cards, as well as a 16-core, 16, I'm trying to think. No, I mean, yeah, it was 16. Core i9 processor from Intel. 32 gigs of RAM, fast Samsung SSD 960 Evo, and just absolutely amazing in terms of design and build. And, you know, there's boutique builders out there that do impressive stuff, no question about it. When you talk about guys like Falcon Northwest, when you talk about guys like Origin PC, you can go on. There are a few that put together these flagship, absolutely beautiful machines. Yeah, but Main Gear on this machine, and Main Gear typically impresses. I mean, they always deliver something really over the top. I mean, it's sort of muscle car, you know, sort of quality that they shoot for. And the owner, or the CEO, and some of the partners at Main Gear, that's where they come from, is they're car guys, and they even set up their shop, by the way, like a high end shop, you know, car shop and performance car shop. Yeah, garage. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. And you see the guys wearing these shirts. It looks like if you've ever seen Fast and Loud on Discovery Channel, that's what it looks like, but it's for computers. And so anyways, they designed some pretty impressive stuff, but this thing is probably the first time in a long time where I've gotten a product in and just sat there in amazement. I remember calling the guys there, and I am gushing. I'm going to gush a little bit, but I'll have you guys chime in with hopefully some balance. But I called the guys, and I'm like, okay, tell me what I'm looking at here, because this thing is wild. And, you know, they walked me through it. Ron Reed, the marketing manager, walked me through it, explained it. You know, hey, we did this, we did that. And I literally had to ask questions about how it was set up and what made it tick, because I'd never seen anything like it. And so you talk about dual liquid cooled GeForce GTX 1080 Ti's. It's got a huge block, the Apex. I don't know if you can cut to a close up of it, John, but the Apex ICS water cooling system is comprised of this huge block of acrylic in the front of the chassis, front side of the chassis, that has multiple feeds. There's, I think, three or four feeds going into it. Don't have it in front of me right now. That send, it's all an open loop system, and the CPUs and GPUs are connected together, but there's multiple feeds. Each complex, CPU and GPU, gets a fresh cool feed from the block and then a warm feed returned back to the radiator. And John, I don't know if you can get another visual up on the screen, but up on the top of the system is this massive 420 millimeter radiator that the blocks, you know, the cooling blocks from the CPUs and GPUs, there you go, feed into. And you can see there's actually three 140 millimeter fans up top to cover that spans. And so large fans, huge radiator up top, huge water block reservoir with non-conductive, you know, cooling, super special, good cooling. And it's got things like a pressure meter and a flow meter. There's this little pinwheel that spins, and you can see how fast the fluid's moving through and, you know, how hard the machine's working. And it really, from a design standpoint, it looks fantastic. It's got all sort of customizable RGB lighting throughout, but it actually performs really well too. So although the CPU and GPUs are fed in the same loop, you know, again, because the system is so large, and I should say the cooling system is large, the actual system is a really a compact ATX. It uses a micro ATX motherboard. But it actually performs so well, even though everything's in a single chain, that it's just impressive to watch. I was testing, you know, just looking at things like, you know, during gaming, obviously that's the primary target for this, high-end gamers. I was testing, looking at GPU temps. So I'd load this thing up 4K Ultra Far Cry 5 and just let it loop. And the GPUs just sat there at like 52C, 55C, you know, and they're overclocked. Everything's overclocked. So that the GPUs are like, I think it was 140 megahertz core and 300 megahertz on the memory. And then the CPU was all cores, 4.4 gigahertz, and nothing sweating. It's quiet. I mean, quiet as a mouse. I think I recorded 45 dB, and it just looked like, looking at it was just like, I mean, if you're a computer guy, you're just drooling. It's pretty fantastic. I was impressed. It takes a lot to impress me because we see so much, but those guys just killed it with this thing. It's $9,627 worth of computer, so it's ridiculously expensive. But wow, impressed. What do you guys think? Am I overselling it here?
Well, let's put that in perspective real quick. So yeah, you said it was 9,200 ish. That's approximately 96. One Xeon 28 core processor. Not that much.
Yeah, everything's relative. Everything's relative. Any thoughts on this bad boy, Margo?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely gorgeous. As much as I love building systems myself, the amount of time it would take to do something with that level of detail, with that level of craftsmanship, you know, with that type of hardware and paint and the loop, you know, and there's no way I'm building the custom block. Like, you literally can't do it without an insane amount of time and an insane amount of resources. Mm-hmm. So I completely dig it. Yeah, it's expensive. But, you know, a main gear rig like that, if you're shopping for it and those are the features that you want, you don't care. You know, you're already driving in something crazy and you want the best PC, and that thing is insane.
You know, I could easily see. So, you know, let's just strip back the niceties, the bling. Let's take the paint job back and you know, just, it's a custom chassis. They had to design a chassis themselves. It's not an off the shelf, you know, Cooler Master or whatever.
Around the water block, mind you.
Right. What's that? Around the water.
When I saw this system at CES, they were explaining to me that they actually started with the acrylic water block and designed the shape of the chassis around it to be a perfect fit.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Oh,
yeah, so it all comes back to that beautiful water block in front.
Yeah. The Apex cooling block. Yeah. John, and flash that thing on again whenever you get a chance. But so if you stripped back, so I'm just kind of think out of the box here. If you stripped back, you know, the lighting bling, the paint job, and you just went with the system itself and how it performs, you could justify, I would wager, justify the cost of this thing as a workstation machine. Like, if you took this thing, put it, you know, in your lab, and, you know, maybe it's instead of that paint job, you know, because it has full automotive paint job, you know, custom, you know, they have a spray booth. It's not just any paint. It's automotive paint. It's the real deal. And then the lighting that's in there, it's all RGB. You got a remote control. You can hit any color of the rainbow and light the thing up. All the water blocks are translucent and, you know, reflect the color of the lighting. It's beautiful. If you took all the bling out and just went with the block, and the machine as well, I'd almost say it performs so well. For high end workstation, you could see somebody stepping up for this in a business environment, you know, if you're rendering or designing or CAD or something like that. But you saw it. It's at CES, Chris, right? What'd you think?
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely gorgeous. So they had probably six or seven of those F-131s in there to Google. And it's mesmerizing just to watch the liquid flow through the system, through the flow meter and everything else. Sorry if you're looking for balance or reservation, but it's a beautiful system. My only question is, why didn't they step up to the Core i9-7980X? I think they skimped you a little bit.
Oh, well, you know, what's interesting is they kept it under 10 grand, and maybe if they went up to that, it would have. I think for our application, you know, we're a consumer facing site. I think they probably split the difference pretty well, because they needed a pair of 1080 Ti's in there that, by the way, they broke pretty much every benchmark record we have across the board, with the exception of higher, lower core count, higher clocked processors that we do have in the database for things like, productivity tests and stuff like that. Like PCMark 8, you know, it didn't rank as high. But every game test, anything with content creation, the thing just, you know, blew everybody else out of the water pretty much, you know, by either a good margin or, you know, something observable. And so it was, yeah, I think they split the cost about right. I mean, if you're going to send out a decked out machine, yeah, they could have added another, what, I don't know, $500,000 with a couple more cores. Yeah. From Intel. But why? You know, what are you going to get out of it? So, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're there in the 10 grand territory, I'd probably opt for that, you know.
I mean, but, and keep in mind, too, if you're getting a rack server to, you know, carry your high processing loads, you're going to be looking at least 10 grand anyways. So why not have a beautiful system? Yeah. Once you get into the multiple socket systems and throw up cores there, it gets expensive pretty quick.
Yeah. Good stuff from the folks at Main Gear down in Kenilworth, New Jersey. We've been there. They're up our neck of the woods in the Northeast here. And, you know, they're nice guys, you know, as well. And, you know, we like working with them, and we don't let, you know, things like relationships get in the way of objectivity when you look at products in a review setting. And I can honestly tell you that this thing just knocked my socks off, whether or not I like the guys and at Main Gear or not. It was just cool stuff. So we will move along. We got anything in the chat here? Let's see. I don't know if we get any. The Intel tax is painful, says Jonexus. Yes, it can be. It's funny that Intel is regarded as a tax now, where it used to be Apple. I don't know.
Still Apple.
It's still Apple. All right. Well, let's move along to the HP ZBook X2 G4, a powerful convertible for creative professionals. This is like night and day. Here we've got a 2-in-1 sub-3-pound machine versus the Main Gear 65-pound machine. Marco, shift gears for us, will you, please?
You know, I am going to shift gears, but it's not night and day. This is like this crazy premium hardcore for its space kind of product. So Tuon looked at this for us. This is HP's convertible workstation, basically. So think of this machine is that it's sort of akin to a Surface Book 2. You have Intel's latest 8th generation core processors, you know, as the main power plant. Also, though, despite its small form factor, with discrete GPU options. So this machine actually has an NVIDIA Quadro M620 with 2 gigs of dedicated memory in there. Also has a fast Samsung NVMe SSD inside, Bang & Olufsen audio, a 14-inch Dreamcolor 4K display. So this is a professional, you know, highly accurate, vibrant display in there as well. Plus, it includes a Wacom EMR pen. So it's not an active pen. You don't have to worry about batteries and stuff like that. You know, the tablet functionality, the Wacom functionality is actually built into the slate. Plus you have that detachable keyboard. So if you want to use it sort of like a clamshell, it does have a kickstand. So you have to deal with the wobbliness on your lap. It's best used on a table, but you have the flexibility to use it as a tablet if you're a creative professional, or as a, you know, more of a traditional notebook. And you have, for this form factor, some really powerful hardware inside. Plus, this is sort of the only machine of this type. With the Surface Book, you have a discrete GPU option, but it's in the base. If you detach the tablet, you're strictly on Intel integrated graphics. You lose that discrete GPU option. HP managed to cram everything into that tablet side. And what we saw through the review was not necessarily the fastest across the board. The GPU really helps it in graphics intensive tests. The CPU wasn't quite as fast as other machines with the same chip, mostly because of the thermal constraints, we believe, in this really small form factor. But you have a really powerful machine for creative pros in this really small tablet form factor with premium materials and build quality with some really cool features. And Tuon ended up really liking it. So the machine we tested was a little over $3,300, which is clearly pricey. They start at about $2,200. But if this is, you know, this could sort of fill a real specific niche if you're a creative professional on the go that will use all of the features offered by this machine. Definitely not for everybody, But if it has the features inside that you'll use, this is a machine worth checking out. It's really premium across the board with lots of really cool stuff inside.
Yeah, yeah. So it's got a Quadro, which is professional application certified NVIDIA Quadro M620. So that's probably an entry level GPU, 2 gigabytes of GDDR5 memory on there. Impressive, you know, from a configuration standpoint for the size machine it is. I wonder what the usage model is. Is this somebody who is you know, breaking out the pen and doing a little, you know, historically would have worked on a Wacom digitizer and doing some markup and drawing? I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I'm trying to think who the target market is.
So the target market is very selective. Now, I have a friend that would kill for this thing.
Really?
My friend Tom. I have a friend named Thomas who has a really genius business, in my opinion. He's a really talented graphic artist.
He started
this really cool business where he's digitally staging houses, right? So he takes pictures of empty houses and digitally adds in all the furniture and retouches the photos and makes them beautiful. And to watch him working on his Wacom, you know, on his desktop, it's wild, man. You know, he knows all the shortcuts, and it's great to see him working on there. I could totally see him, because he also travels a bit to some locations to get the photos done with the photographer, but he's got to come home to work on them. I could totally see him using something like this on the go if he's got to do something quick turn. So yeah, I mean, it is obviously a selective group of creative professionals that would use this machine, but they are out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And if you can leverage this with travel, it's going to make your money back, because all that dead travel time that you have now, you're now monetizing. So it doesn't really matter what it costs, as long as it's reasonable, which it seems is reasonable enough. Very, very nice for those use cases.
Yeah. Yeah. I was with the folks at Dell this week to shift gears on another brand, but it was funny that one of the data points we got was that there is a small percentage of folks that, you know, care about the stylus, that care about pen input, but when they do, they're all in. Like they're like that pen is very much a tool, and I think that's really what this thing's all about, is, you know, that creative professional performance and features in a 2-in-1 detachable form factor. Yeah, man, it's great to see how the OEMs are fleshing out some of these products that, you know, are pretty specialized. I'm not a big detachable guy. For me, lappability is important. And so having that keyboard that's sort of a little flappy and a kickstand in the back for me wouldn't work so well. But a lot of folks, where you just want to pick something up and, you know, draw and annotate on it directly, you know, they can't live without it, I guess. Yeah. Is this your kind of thing, Marco? I mean, I know you're a real thin and light kind of guy.
I'm with you. If I have to be on the go, I prefer an actual clamshell. Using it on my lap is just doesn't work. Like, I have a Surface Pro, and I've never been happy using it on my lap. And it's also really hard to use it on a tray table as they get smaller and smaller on airplanes. So a clamshell is ideal for me, and I wouldn't use the stylus. You know, I wouldn't use the Wacom functionality. So with that said, I do think this is a really cool machine. I love to see these well-executed, stylized, you know, highly functional machines. Yeah, they're not for everyone, but I dig this device. It's pretty cool.
Right. I'll make a projection, actually, as well, that we're just now starting to see the evolution of the 2-in-1, whether it be clamshell or 360 degree swing hinges. Certainly detachables are their own little market segment as well. Folks that want really what's ultimately a serviceable tablet. You know, some of the 360 hinges on a 14 or 15 inch machine, for example, are a very unwieldy tablet. This machine could be a bona fide tablet on its own. But I will make a projection, and we saw a little hint of this, and we don't have this in the show links in the show headlines. Out at Computex, Asus came out with, what was it, Project Precor or something like that. I'm not getting the name right, but they had a dual screen machine, a dual display machine, where you have glass on both the top and bottom. I think that's perhaps the next evolution in ergonomics here that we're going to be looking at, where the keyboard area, you know, sometimes you're going to be tapping on glass. Maybe you have a detachable keyboard that somehow works in there, but the keyboard area or that interface area down by your hands is also going to be display usable in some way. And I think Asus is sort of tipping their hand. I think there are others following that trend, and I won't get into them. I think this is the next thing we'll start seeing is dual displays, you know, flexible displays with contiguous workspace between the vertical and the horizontal in front of you. It's going to be cool. It's really fascinating to watch this stuff. You know, every year we think we've seen something cool, and then the next year we see something cooler.
Well, you know, it's funny, like tablets are essentially dead. You know, Google's getting out of the tablet business. All of the focus right now is on premium notebooks and 2-in-1 convertible devices, as it should be. Tablets were stupid. We knew they weren't going to take anything over. You know, you can't get any work done on a straight up tablet, you know, unless your work involves just reading emails. So, yeah, the 2-in-1 category is hot. And yeah, I agree. You're going to see, I don't know how much innovation they can do, you know, with that form factor, but you are going to see lots of new stuff, and people are going to take some funky shots, I think, moving forward.
John, fast work there, buddy. Pull that sucker back up. That was Asus Project Precog. There it is. Project Precog, dual screen AI laptop concept. I think this is more than a concept. I think there's going to be some critical mass behind this design approach. And so what you're seeing there is a keyboard on glass. You've got a second display. So think of that second display underneath the main display in front of the keyboard as just more workspace, more controls. So instead of having function buttons that usually go to waste, you know, 90% of the time, you've got this display area that's touch interface enabled. And then it can also convert in one fell swoop into an entire contiguous display that you can use for one image. You know, let's say you're on an image or designing or something like that, and now you've got two screens to scroll through. It's a fascinating approach and a use case. It's going to be hard, I think, for some folks to adapt to typing on glass. I think there's going to be different vehicles for that. You might see detachable keyboards and stuff. Oh. But you'll get used to tapping on glass too with haptics. They're going to include haptics with that, I bet. What do you think, Chris? I hear you grunting over there.
I'm just wondering if this is what Apple had in mind for their end game with their touch bar that everyone made fun of, because this is kind of that on steroids as it takes over your whole keyboard. I don't know how happy I would be to be typing an extended amount on a touchscreen. No matter how good the haptics are, it's still kind of, I need to feel the keys. But if it is for workloads that are less typing centric and more, say, photo editing or other kinds of digital artwork and such, then it could be more attractive. I'm not so sure about it being the everyman's factor, though. But yeah. I like to see the experimentation pushing the form factors in crazy new ways, because you never know what's going to be the next iPhone or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting thing. And the glass thing, I think, Chris, I would wager, and you know, and I'm kind of with you. I need a mechanical keyboard. Marco, I know you're a keyboard snob. Even membrane key switches drive you nuts. But I actually was talking to an analyst and journalist the other day at a meeting that shall remain nameless. And she was working with an iPad and she was banging on the glass. And I'm like, doesn't that drive you nuts? She's like, no, I totally adapted to it. It took me a while, but I came up to it. I came up the learning curve and I'm fine. And
I'm not going to downplay this journalist, this or analyst, whoever it was, But it's completely pointless to me when you can have an actual keyboard in a form factor, maybe a couple of millimeters and few ounces heavier with a more performant platform. It just makes no sense to me. So
I could do it. I wouldn't
Exactly.
I can't get into to some of the other applications I've seen of how this works. But I can tell you, number one, that what the benefit is, the keyboard area, the work surface area, it doesn't always have to be keyboard. That's the benefit. Obviously, now you've got two displays that you can repurpose to whatever you want, and different applications will adapt to it. Obviously, you have to have the software hooks to utilize it, but that keyboard area isn't keyboard all the time if it doesn't need to be. That's portability and efficiency. I agree. There's ergonomics that aren't as great on glass, but if you bring in a detachable keyboard in with a device like that, you kind of may have the best of both worlds. Now you're still talking dual screen, type on glass if you want, mechanical keyboard, wireless, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you're still facing the issue. When you have a physical keyboard, you can rest your fingertips. And I think, as you always kind of, with a touch screen, would have to keep your fingers just above. I think you're going to run into exhaustion regardless quicker than you would with a physical keyboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Joe Nexus reminded me of a feature. I'll answer the chat stuff right after. But another really cool feature of that HP machine, if you detach the keyboard, it automatically switches to Bluetooth and you can use it wireless. That's a cool feature too. Like, there's tons of smart stuff in that machine.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So you were mentioning Joe Nexus. I was reading that chat too about it. It was Lenovo. I think it was called the Yoga Book that had that dual screen little small portable device. And Joe also mentions he thinks it was Asus that had Ryzen with Vega 56 in a laptop. That was Acer. Acer put a desktop Ryzen CPU and Vega 56 in a big monster gaming notebook. Not a monster. Right. It was thick in the back. But yeah, it was Acer that pulled that off.
And he also said you can't beat Lenovo for the keyboards, and I would agree. And what I don't understand, and maybe it's space, maybe that's the answer, but what I don't understand is why do I like a Lenovo keyboard? It's not key travel, okay, because we all, we can get key travel, competitive between the different machines, different brands. Shaped keycaps. Why do we have to have chiclets all the time? Everybody else except Lenovo, in the ThinkPad series does chiclets. They have shaped keycaps. It fits my fingers better. That's ergonomic.
It's not just the shape too, though. It's the tactility. It's the rigidity. It's the actuation.
Force profile.
Lenovo does have the force profile. Lenovo has the science down.
Yeah, they do, and I think others should take note from it. I think shape is probably the biggest differentiator, though, because I think others have approximated the tactility. We've seen some pretty impressive stuff. It's like, come on, man. You can do this too. So I don't know why we're stuck with chiclets, little square things that, I don't know. My mechanical keyboard, they're square keycaps, but they're shaped. I have a lot more room on the mechanical keyboard. They're concave to cradle my fingers. That is comfort. That's, as you're typing, your fingers aren't flat and square. They're round. You're a human. Nature doesn't have straight lines. Damn it. All right. Let's move along. We've been harping on this. We got only a few minutes to go, and let's move along to some new things in the mobile space, staying on the mobile trend. Chris, you were with the good folks at ARM checking out their new Cortex A76 and Mali G76. This is going to be architecture for next generation mobile devices of all sorts. And they're talking notebook level performance, right?
Yeah. So anytime ARM makes an announcement like this, it's really like peering into a crystal ball because, of course, they don't manufacture their own chips. They license it out to other companies who make the chips using their designs. So from what we're seeing here today, they have some test silicon out, but the production silicon is not going to be arriving until the end of this year at best, probably early 2019, depending on how the process goes. But anyways, so this is back to the tech day I was at earlier this month, also in Austin, where it was at the upper end of damn hot.
Yeah,
not quite crazy, but so for we already covered the machine learning side of things, which they kind of let out a little bit early to get it out of the way for the new core designs that they have that they announced last week, which is the Cortex A76. And the Mali G76 and V76 GPU and video processor units. So starting with the, I guess, headline Cortex A76, they really went back to the drawing board with it. They have a whole new ground up architecture because they felt like, especially with the changes in machine learning and other things, they really needed to get a whole ground up change on their design so that they could incorporate the better features, the things like dot 8 product support. Sorry, basically all machine learning right now, for the most part anyways, is being done on the 8-bit level, so they really wanted to accelerate that aspect of it. But even with the cores themselves, for general processing, they have a lot of improvements, changing the pipelining. Let me bring up the features. So they're looking at a little bit of a die shrink, but their designs are meant to be scalable. So whatever the industry wants to create their chips on, whether it's 16 nanometer, 12 nanometer, 10 nanometer, 7, etc. They can do that. So you're going to see a lot of variance, even if something is built as an A76 core. You can see a lot of change, whether it's a budget, which they're looking at probably the 12 nanometer process for that, or if it's a more performance-oriented 7 nanometer chip or even 5 nanometer in the future. They have that ability to scale, and they also scale the chips in different ways. So you can customize the cache a lot more than you could in previous generations. So say level 1 cache is 64K, and that seems pretty rigid. And then you move up to either 256 or 512K of level 2 cache, and then 2 to 4 megs of level 3 cache. So this is building on the dynamic cluster architecture that they had, that they introduced last year with the A75 and A55, which kind of takes their big little design, which has, you know, the high performing core like your A75, A76, and pairs it with a high efficiency core, which would be the A55 in both cases. But instead of having the 4-and-4 configuration like we've seen for years and years since Big Little was introduced, it's now, they can now shift that arrangement. So you could have maybe 1 or 2 big cores and 6 or 7 little cores, up to a total of 8, which can make a very nice difference for the budget or efficiency minded chips, because you don't necessarily need 4 big cores to go crazy, but you might want more than just 8 little cores. Scalability is definitely a huge goal that they have here. And it seems like they're making that accessible for their licensees. And we're also seeing, in general terms of performance, they're looking at about 35% more integer performance than the A75. And more power efficiency. So since these are intended for mobile devices, whether they're phones or laptops, battery life is going to be a huge component of that. So they're saying that they can do equal workloads on both 40% more efficiently. So you're using less power, and that lets you use your device for longer, or, you know, allows some manufacturers to skimp on battery here or there, whatever they want to do. I personally want the largest battery I can get, but it's very nice to see these improvements in the mobile space, especially as we're looking at always on laptops.
Yeah. Let's connect the dots for folks a little bit too, with respect to ARM. If you're not familiar with ARM, basically there's kind of two architectures in the consumer space right now that exist mm-hmm. for processor architectures. There's x86, which is Intel and AMD. And then there's ARM, which is a RISC architecture versus CISC, reduced instruction set versus, I forget, complex instruction set. Anyways, these are architectures that have been around for a long, long time. ARM powers the majority of every smartphone, Android, and Apple device on the market today. So that is the core architecture that guys like Qualcomm and others, Apple, license to build chips. They license ARM core technology. And so this is huge for mobile. And I also noticed another bullet point on there, Chris, 90% higher memory bandwidth. That's huge.
Yeah, so because 90%. It's a faster chip. Right, they really wanted to do that. And it's not just straight through the bandwidth. They also have a lot of clever compression and other things that help them pass more information through it. But in terms of effective memory bandwidth, yeah, you can see up to a 90% improvement in their reference design, of course. How the licensees choose to implement that can make things vary. But it is it is definitely there. Yeah. And then I see in the chat that Joe Nexus is saying that he thinks an A76 could be painful for low-end PC laptops, but have kick-ass battery. What's interesting is after a little bit of prying, the ARM representatives kind of gave out a number that the A76 core as a single core performs within about 90% of a single Skylake core, given the same thermal constraint, but it just half the area.
Huh.
So interesting. I don't think it's going to be as painful as people are expecting it to be. Now, there are considerations like when you're looking at a Windows device with it, because Windows has the legacy of being x86, you know, especially when you get the older applications, you know, there are translations taking place that are going to add overhead to the process. So you're going to see those slow down. But Microsoft is also making native ARM compilations very accessible to developers. So things like Office are already available for ARM, fully optimized. So it's bypassing all that x86 translation and getting right to the performance. So, you know, with the web browsers and other things that we're seeing in common usage, I don't think it's going to be a big deal. Are you going to be doing huge CAD workloads and everything else on it? Probably not, but that's not really what they're there for. I think the biggest issue ARM is facing in the notebook space right now is cost. When, you know, the few ARM laptops we have out with older core designs are, you know, they're pretty expensive. So unless you're really looking for that endless battery life, always on experience, they don't make a bunch of sense yet, but it's a growing market. And I'll also say ARM was careful to say they're not actively going after the notebook market. They're still focused on mobile, like smartphones and VR experience type workloads primarily. That it can be in a notebook is a nice side effect.
Yeah. You know, and that's an interesting segue for me, Chris. I was going to talk a little bit about Qualcomm Snapdragon 850, but you make a good point about the initial offering of Snapdragon always connected Windows 10 PCs. The manufacturers came out at some price points that you would have expected them to be a little bit more aggressive on. When you think about you know, the silicon in a phone, and you think about the price of the average smartphone, $600 or $700, that's kind of where you expected these machines to be. Larger mm-hmm. displays, keyboards, the whole thing to add in cost. But I think what we're looking at here is really economies of scale in that regard from a cost standpoint. And I think as things like Snapdragon, and, you know, as Qualcomm's relationship with Microsoft continues to evolve, and they came out recently with 64-bit SDK, ARM SDK support in Windows 10 for 64-bit, full 64-bit native Windows apps to, you know, for developers. As that evolves, I think the cost and you know, equation will probably begin to take care of itself. Right. We'll see. But yeah, so Qualcomm.
But I don't think ARM notebooks need to be the budget option either. I think they can compete on a premium to premium level. Again, yeah, with the caveat that they are more oriented towards battery life and efficiency, with that always on experience.
Yeah, fair enough, for sure. Qualcomm stepped out with the Snapdragon 850 mobile platform for always connected Windows 10 PCs. That's the other headline. We'll burn through real quick. We're going a little bit long tonight, but that is an evolution, we believe, although Qualcomm didn't quite come out and say it. John, I don't know if you can bring that up. I think it's an evolution of Snapdragon 845 optimized for the always connected, you know, 2-in-1. There's a good screenshot right there. I believe that's an HP machine. I'm not sure. But 2-in-1 detachables and in general, very thin and light notebooks, you know, 3-pound or less machines. And Snapdragon 850, if you think about the initial crop of machines that came out, these were Snapdragon 835s that were driving them. Snapdragon 845 takes that performance up a notch, in some case 20 and 30%, especially when it comes to graphics. There is also efficiencies from a power standpoint where they can spin down cores. The clock gating is a little bit more dynamic and controllable. 850, I think, is optimized for that power envelope. And it's a derivative of 845. This is my guess. Again, Qualcomm didn't come out and say that, didn't confirm it. That's my hunch. And so it will be interesting when we get those products in market, and they'll be out this year, to see how that performance maps out. Because the initial crop of Snapdragon 835 machines on the market, you know, they were good for basic productivity tasks, but they were a little pokey in spots. And, you know, when you get into things like, you know, higher end content creation, stuff like that, you know, these are the types of machines that, you know, aren't going to excel there. But when you talk about the migration from, you know, Snapdragon 835 to 845 in the handsets and the performance improvements we saw there, couple that with eventually, hopefully, native 64-bit apps, a little bit larger memory space. These things could get interesting, right? So,
right, we're very, very early in the ARM on Windows process. So,
yes,
I think it's definitely too early to call them out, like,
right,
yeah, say they're not going to make it.
Yeah. And the other thing is, don't make the mistake and think that this is Windows RT again. It is not. Microsoft is a different company now. You get Satya Nadella behind the helm, and they are driving this thing for really native compatibility. Sure, you know, you've got support and emulation for Win32 apps, but what they're going for is, you know, get the ARM 64 SDK in the hands of developers, flesh out the ecosystem, make things native, you know, and you know, third party support from ISVs, not just, you know, emulation, you know, straight up, right on the metal, native. So fun to watch. Big changes in the market. If ARM makes a dent in Intel's market share or an x86 market share in general, with you know, Windows platforms, that's going to be, yeah, that's like hell freezing over, dogs and cats living together, all the kind of mayhem, right?
Absolutely. So Joe in the chat says, wonder if Intel is going to sue ARM or Qualcomm for x86 emulation. They're actually not doing x86 emulation in hardware. This is all Microsoft's doing. Intel's probably has no leg to stand on there.
They postured, and they always will, and they could very well sue, because God knows lawyers love lawsuits whether or not they hold water. But yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. Should we wrap up, guys, or cover that last segment? What do you think? We got a few more minutes.
I'll turbo it. I'll literally do it in 30 seconds.
All right, man, go for it. Google Home versus Amazon Echo. Which do you choose?
So I personally, I choose the Echo, but we had a really cool article. One of our writers, Chris, not this Chris, another Chris, he for himself basically bought a Google Home and an Amazon Echo to see which one he'd like better and which one he was going to keep. And we decided to turn it into an article. He looked at the aesthetics, the sound quality from the speakers, you know, how good their AI or the natural language was. He also looked at their smart home capabilities, the quality of their microphones, how well they picked up from long distance, making phone calls from the devices, and of course, pricing. I'm not going to give away the conclusion. Come by the site, check it out. But it's a really interesting article if you're considering one of these smart speakers. The winner may surprise you. I'll leave it at that. Whoa.
Yeah. they're different machines from two very different companies, and we'll leave it at that. Check it out. It's a fascinating piece, and it's something where, you know, you've got two big, powerful players, Amazon and Google. I mean, talk about juggernauts vying for the smart home automation market. And that's a big frontier, and it's going to be a lucrative one. And yeah, it's great to see them duking it out, and they're approaching it a little bit differently. But yeah, we'll let you come by and check it out, read the article. Marco, you're going to get busy real soon. You're going to get busy real soon building some magic, right? In your, your workshop?
I am. I see some of this stuff is over my shoulder. I strategically positioned it. So we had a contest last month. Took a little while to get all the hardware here. Some stuff was back ordered, but I now have all of the Corsair and AMD hardware to build Eric his contest system. I am going to wrap up a review tonight and into tomorrow and then jump into that build video, and we'll get that posted and you can see the machine before I ship it off to the winner.
Nice. Nice. You got Ryzen 5 back there. You've got some Corsair goodies. And our winner, Beholder 88. Is that the right name? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
He scored that sucker. And yeah, we do this almost every month. We give away something. Swing on by. Leave a comment in the chat or down below in the comments if you have ideas on stuff we should give away, and we'll try and make it happen.
Right? Really good odds of winning.
Good odds of winning. Yes, actually. There's lots of folks that are regulars on the site that you'll see commenting across the site at hothardware.com who have won, and they will tell you what they won. They're pretty proud of it. So swing on by hothardware.com, or you can find us on the web, youtube.com/hothardware or hothardwarevids, where you should not only subscribe, but hit that reminder bell, and then make sure you get the reminders, because then you'll know when we stream. And that's important. And twitter.com/hothardware, facebook.com/hothardware, where we don't mine your data directly. Facebook does, but we don't. And and that's about it, guys. Thanks for stopping by. Parting words for the viewers, gentlemen.
No, thanks for participating, Craig and Joe, in the chat and anybody else who was watching. Good to have you. The one down vote that we traditionally get when I find out who it is, not going to be good. But yeah, that's it.
Gonna come get you all Italian style. You're in trouble.
Oh, you know, it's somebody on my Facebook friends list, you know, that saw the notification and has a little wants to sing us, but I'll find out somehow.
It's all right. We love the hate, we love the love, we just feed on the energy, right? That just we get big and strong that way.
Yeah. I mean, the secret is all interaction is good interaction, really. Coming into the video, giving us a view, downvoting actually helps us rise up the rankings. So you're doing us a favor, whether you think you're doing it or not.
There you go. There you go. Perfect. Perfect. Hey, and on that note, I will say thanks for joining and thanks for stopping by.